This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even if you've never worked in an actual office, you probably have an idea of what it's like. From Office Space to Dilbert to The Office, we've got plenty of examples of cookie-cutter cubicles where workers toil away in soul-crushing boredom and fatigue. It's little wonder so many people choose to work from home or make a go at being their own boss as freelancers or entrepreneurs. But beyond the stained coffee mugs and ignored emails, maybe something about working in an office that we are attached to and actually benefits more than the idea of freedom. Jennifer Senior is contributing editor for New York Magazine, where she wrote an ode to the office. And Jennifer Senior, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, The Office has gotten such a bad rap. You use a terrific line in the book that they are like factories in drag. And for many years now, we've been talking about we're heading for a home office society. You know, people are telecommuting, if we remember that term. What percentage of people say they would prefer not to work in an office?
Oh, well, in the United States, it's the majority. I think it's 63% according to, you know, one particular very comprehensive study that I looked at. And in most industrialized nations, like in Europe, it's close to a majority, you know, at least a plurality of people would want some kind of flexible arrangement, if not a home arrangement or to work for themselves. So it's very appealing in theory to work for yourself.
But in practice, how many people actually work for themselves?
It depends on how you count, right? The answer is far fewer. The official count in the United States is that it's just a shade over 10% of us are self-employed. But that number is very narrow. It does not take into consideration things like temp workers or people who work seasonally or people who work, you know, on the food prep line. Consultants. I mean, there are people who might draw wages, you know, from a variety of places and consider themselves wage earners in one survey, but not in the current population survey. So if you look at that, the Government Accountability Office has said that 31% of us are contingent in some way. So it depends on who does the counting. But again, not everybody who's contingent wants to be contingent.
Well, that's a distinction that you make in the piece. I mean, we have what I've heard called permalancers, another term, precariats, you know, precarious proletariats. But, you know, there are people who are boasting about being able to work in their pajamas and making their own schedule. But there are a lot of people who are not choosing to be freelancers. What's the distinction here? Freelancers by choice or by design, as you say?
Right. Well, okay, there are two ways to look at this. First of all, I think that embedded in the word freelancer versus contingent worker is a big class distinction, right? Freelancer has the word free in it. It suggests that you're self-determining, that you're autonomous, that you're choosing your destiny. When we think of freelancers, we often think of white-collar professions. We think of landscape architects and graphic designers. And when we think of contingent workers, we think of day laborers. So that's one thing. The other thing is that you have to make the distinction between those who are entrepreneurs or self-employed by choice and those who are self-employed because they were put out to pasture and had no choice.
Well, you went to a seminar at the Freelancers Union and described the crowd, which was who was there primarily?
Right. So this is what was interesting to me. I expected it to be more women than men, and I expected it to be very young. It was more men than women. The median age, if I had to guess, was about 40. And the range was interesting. Some people were there because they were gung-ho about starting a freelance life, and other people had been let go. And they just, this was what they were doing because they didn't think that they would necessarily find a home again in the traditional workforce.
Mm-hmm. So is that the new sort of euphemism for someone who's been let out to pasture? I'm an entrepreneur?
No, you know, I don't know how promiscuously people use that word. I wouldn't say that everybody there was identifying as such, although some certainly were. I don't know if you've seen this statistic, but Intuit, the software company in Silicon Valley, they predicted in 2020 that 40% of us would be freelancers of some kind, you know, contingent in some way. And this statistic has been repeated over and over again, so much so that it's almost become truth through continual citation. Mm-hmm. And when I first heard it, I thought, I mean, really? You know, it's a private sector number. Intuit has a vested interest in this number being true because then they can prepare our tax software. Mm-hmm. So, but then I spoke to former Labor Secretary Robert Reich about it, and he said, "Yeah, that sounds about right. If you count all the people who are contingent workers, who are part-time workers, who have a variety of kind of independent contracts, that's not so far off." And so I don't know what that class of workers is going to wind up calling itself in the future, but it does seem to be the way the world is trending.
Mm. Well, let's get back to the office.
Yeah.
You are kind of a fan of the office. What are some of the advantages as far as you're concerned and what you found in your research?
Right. So, you know, the office gets a very bad rap that it's kind of this big wasteland of depersonalization, that, you know, we're all just a bunch of sad, sorry cogs and drones. And I get that. And certainly the depiction of the office in pop culture looks that way. Here is what people take for granted about offices, and I think you start to notice it if you're not in one. And it's something that I think we will miss when they start to evaporate. Number one, camaraderie and collaboration, kind of collegiality. I'm sorry, I'm being very alliterative and using lots of C's. But your colleagues provide all sorts of hidden value. They make you better at your job in some cases, either because they're so good at it that they're sort of showing you what's possible, but also because they're helping you. They're your collaborators. They know the office politics, and they can tell you who to avoid and where all the good resources are. Your bosses and your best colleagues often know your strengths and weaknesses, you know, mm-hmm. So that's something. People meet their spouses at the office. This is underrated. I think we have to talk about that for
points.
A second. I mean, it's extremely common, much more common than one would think. And there have been all sorts of polls done about this and stuff. And I think it rivals, if not exceeds, it at least rivals online dating in terms of like the number one place that you meet a mate.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, at Southwest Airlines, something like 2,000 employees are married to each other out of the, you know, 35,000. I mean, I'll just throw out a couple of examples. I mean, people that you might have heard of who met at the office would be Barack and Michelle Obama.
Mm-hmm.
When they were lawyers, or say Bill and Melinda Gates, you know, I mean, you know, some very famous couples.
So many people are now choosing to work from home. We're living in the economy of the freelancer, or so we are told. How many people actually do freelance work, and how many of them still work in offices? We're getting a little bit of love for the office from Jennifer Senior, a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Something that I hear from a lot of freelancers is their cultivation of creativity, their collaboration happens in places like, you know, the coffee shop where they're borrowing the Wi-Fi, or online in these kind of creative communities or Google Hangouts.
Coffee shops, you're not going to go there and get like kind of the resources that you need if you're working on something, right? Those are sort of built into an office, which is subscribing to the, you know, publications that you need or has the IT infrastructure that you need. It also has people who think like you do, who do what you do, and who have expertise in what you do. When I handed in my first draft of my story, I handed it to editors who've edited me a million times and know every dumb habit I have, and are able to look and to say, please don't do that in those four paragraphs, because we hate it when you do that, and you're your own worst enemy. No one in a coffee shop can tell me that. You know, if I show it to my colleagues who I trust, they're going to be a lot better at evaluating what I write than the barista is. I mean, I think that co-working spaces could possibly provide that, and I think that's why they're enormously popular right now.
That's between you and colleagues. You also mentioned a traditional compact between employers and employees fading away. Aren't those some of the lines that we have wanted to do away with in the past?
No. I think the kinds that I was talking about were, like, the compact meaning the more paternalistic compact, which is like, we'll take care of you and your family. Mm-hmm. We'll give you health insurance. We'll give you a pension. And all of that is fading away. And, I mean, I wouldn't hail that as a good thing. I mean, maybe it was never I guess you could make the argument, and you probably should, that it was never really a corporation's job to provide those things to begin with. I mean, call me a socialist, but I think it would be nice if, you know, the government stepped in and provided more protections in those ways for, you know, for people. But that was the kind of compact that I was talking about kind of disappearing.
You write about this kind of 20-something attitude that entrepreneurship is not something you do. You know, it's not starting a company, but it's this kind of way of thinking. Now, how does that change the whole balance of, you know, how we approach office work or how we approach creative work?
Right. No, I think that this was one of the most interesting things that I stumbled across, was this finding from a fellow named Dan Chabel that 20-somethings, millennials, tend to think of work, of entrepreneurship, not as starting a company, but as like a way of life, a mindset. Their sensibility reflects what we sort of know to be the case, which is that the world of work is changing, the future of work is very different, and that what work is going to mean is a series of engagements. It's not going to necessarily be one career at one place. In fact, it's not clear to me that millennials even think of work as a place, which is mind-blowing. You know, they think of it, again, as something much more amorphous and, you know, as a string of things. This is something else that I talk about, one of the benefits of work. One of the positive things about an office is that it represents kind of object permanence to people, that it is, in fact, a place that helps forge your identity. If you go to IBM, you're an IBMer, you're a Googler, you're an NPR person. You know, you've got your name on the door, you have your desk where your desk is, you have your own telephone extension. It sort of helps establish who you are. Whereas if you're sitting at home and you're working for yourself and no one's calling, are you a graphic designer if no one wants your work? Mm. Are you an ad copy person if no one's ringing? I don't know if you are or not.
But do you think some people are just better built for that? I mean, yes. Some are made to be more entrepreneurial?
Yes, and I think it definitely intersects with temperament. Some people can tolerate uncertainty, and I think that frankly, is a lot of what having an entrepreneurial temperament is about. It's not about tolerating risk-taking. It's about tolerating ambiguity. Mm-hmm. I think that's really tough. Also, I think a certain amount of extroversion helps, because it's not just about doing work. It's about acquiring it, and you have to hustle a lot to get work, you know, if you're working for yourself. It doesn't land in your lap. That's one of the nice things about being in an office. It's one of the bad things, too. You're being told what to do. But the flip side of that is just having to run around and shake a lot of bushes, you know, and have a lot of dinners and to sort of never know when you are supposed to stop cultivating, you know, your contacts.
Mm. Sounds exhausting to me, quite honestly.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, what I'm wondering if that is the wave of the future. Can people be better trained for that? And can they learn to be better disciplined to keep themselves on that track?
I imagine that, you know, with more experience comes more discipline in these things. That if you spend enough time learning about how to drumming up your own business, then sure, you will at some point learn your own limits and learn when to call it quits. But I've yet to meet any modern person who knows exactly when to stop looking at their email. There is this funny paradox in that often freelancing is the best way to bust into a profession, but you often have to have a lot of really great experience in a profession to be able to freelance and to go at it on your own. And there's a lot of really intriguing data and literature about this. I mean, first of all, 55 to 64-year-olds are one of the biggest kind of one of the most robust expanding kind of categories of entrepreneur. It's great to have that kind of expertise behind you. The other thing to say about kind of freelancing and experience is that a lot of, you know, elderly, you know, kind of guru management types will say to young people, first get a job with a big company if you can, because you need mentors in this world. You know, you need to know people first. So ironically, although it's millennials who are probably the most fetishistic about kind of working for themselves, it's probably young people who would be best off first losing themselves in some bigger institution, which is, I guess, in asthma, if you've grown up watching Steve Carell or Ricky Gervais in The Office, but, like, might be the right thing to do.
Well, I have to say, when I think about it, I get so much from the kind of collaborative atmosphere at work. But I think we are living in an economy where all of us are expected to think about, like, okay, if the bottom just falls out, what are you going to do by yourself? What does that thought do to you, Jennifer?
I'm just one of these people that doesn't tolerate ambiguity well. I mean, I came out in my story, full disclaimer, you know, I am a creature of the office. I like showing up. You know, I'm not one of these people that goes, oh, great, it's just me in the open road. Goody, I can't wait. That's not my thing, you know, but it's some people's thing. It's just not mine.
Jennifer Senior, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you.
Jennifer Senior is contributing editor at New York Magazine. She's also author of the book All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. A link to read her article, To the Office with Love, can be found at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And the tales from the cubicle continue. Up next, we're going to hear an insurance salesman who grew tired of his drab office and transformed it into a covert after-hours art gallery. We'll hear that story when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few years ago, amid the cubicles and conference rooms of a San Francisco life insurance office, an insurance salesman decided to become an after-hours curator. Sean Fletcher took down the sleepy landscapes and equestrian scenes that hung on the office walls and exhibited his friend's artwork instead. Here's the story.
My name is Sean Fletcher, and I'm the artist in residence, if you will, of the office/gallery. The office gallery is a covert space operated in the San Francisco offices of a national firm. We're in the office of my employer. His name's Herb, and I think he's okay with it. I mean, I never necessarily asked to do any of this. You get a little tired of looking at prints of equestrian paintings, or, you know, there's a photograph of an albatross floating lightly over blue waves, and you get tired of it. So one afternoon on a Saturday, I came in with a couple of friends and took it down and put up our own stuff. And I've been curating shows here under the auspices of the office gallery ever since then. Okay, well, why don't we start over here? This is a piece by a woman named Renee Shear. Renee's been collecting pennies that she finds on the street. And she's put them up here as to whether she found them heads up or heads down. They're all in these little plastic bags. So, and then they've got a little tag as the date that she found them. She's an interesting artist. She's been cataloging baby buggies, too, that pass by on the street. Now, I'm doing this, you know, while I'm at work. So for all anybody knows, you were sitting up in the waiting room there because you wanted to talk to me about your retirement portfolio. By the way, if you did want to talk about that, we can talk. But you'd call, you'd make an appointment, and then I'd come down and take you through the office gallery. So, yeah, so I don't tell anybody that I'm doing it, and nobody ever asks. I'm totally dependent on bureaucracy here, and that's just the way it works. I'm relatively sure that even if I did hang something offensive up in that conference room, that by the time it got around to who's responsible for that, I want that down, who do I talk to? By the time it got around to me, I'd probably have that down and new work up again. Sometimes putting these things together is a really seat-of-my-pants operation. I wish that I could say that I have gone out and canvassed the globe for artists that deal with this topic or that topic when we curate a show here. I usually say, hey, do you know somebody that works with statistics in their art? And one of the artists I've worked with or one of my friends will say, yeah, why don't you talk to so-and-so? Okay, and then I'll talk to them for a few minutes and they'll tell me about what they're doing. And yeah, that sounds really good. So, you know, I got another artist in the show. I studied art. I get a master's degree in art. I have an art resume. I've had shows. There was a mural on this wall that kept me up at night because I didn't know how that was going to go over when people came in the morning and found out that we'd painted on the wall here. Yeah, it said, keep your money, in big letters across the top. And there was this map of the United States with these eagles. There was a woman named Jo Jackson that did the piece, but just sanded it off, painted over it. I thought it was going to be a lot of work, but it actually turned out not to be. For a while, it was also nice because the security guards knew what was going on. I usually have coffee and donuts for my openings. That's my thing, I guess. That would always give them the leftover donuts or beer or whatever was still hanging around. And we had this kind of unspoken relationship that it was okay and nobody gave me too much of a hassle. I had this opening here, though, and I got this call from the operations people asking me if I had some kind of an event here that night. And I got really belligerent and was like, what do you mean an event? I didn't have an event here. We had a study group. People have study groups here all the time. What's the deal? And there are 100 people signed in. I had no idea there were that many people here. 100 people. Wow, that many, huh? Didn't seem like that many. So ever since then, I've had to be kind of careful about how that works out. I get calls every once in a while from either clients of Herb's and mine that have seen this show and then gone back to their office and said, yeah, this really weird thing going on at Herb's office got curated art rotating every once in a while. And then they'll call and they'll say, how did you do that? Can we get artists to do that here? And I'll just put them in touch with whoever did it. My catchphrase is, I don't have anything to do with it. That's not why I'm here. You know, I'm making money already. I work here.
And that story was produced by Raquel Maria Dillon. And a postscript to Sean Fletcher's story. After 3 years, he was fired from his job and forced to close the Covert Gallery. He's now an artist and financial planner living in San Francisco. Shuttered record and bookstores, dying newspapers, free music, and bankrupt symphonies. While President Obama last night boasted about parts of the economy recovering from the recession, creative industries are limping along. Up next, a former arts reporter details the perilous plight of American arts and culture. That's after the news, when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a news and information consumer, you are a witness to the fall of legacy media. Magazines folding, record and movie companies battling piracy, the rise of cheap reality TV shows, and print media circling the drain. In the 3 years after 2008, newspapers cut 40,000 jobs, unleashing hordes of freelance writers to compete in the information economy. Former LA Times arts reporter Scott Timberg was among those let go. Casualties, we are told, of shifting technological, social, and economic trends. In a series of essays for Salon, Timberg detailed something much deeper and far-reaching in creative destruction, an ongoing assault on the creative class that he argues has been underway since long before file sharing or the iPhone. Those essays are compiled in a new book called The Culture Crash. And Scott Timberg, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
In this book, you make it clear that the creative class is not just the writers and the musicians and the actors or creators of culture, but those that you call their often mocked supporting casts. Like who?
Well, the part of the supporting cast that's most important to me is people who engage directly with people curious about books and music and movies. So I'm talking about a group that used to be much larger, which is bookstore and record store and video store clerks. And it's funny, I don't know the scene in New Hampshire, but since the mid-90s, we've added about 60 million people to the U.S. economy, and we have about half as many independent bookstores as we had back then. Mm-hmm. So the numbers of these people are declining. They're an important part of it. People who work in these places have committed themselves to being around this stuff. You know, they love books, they love music, they love movies. But the creative class is broad and complex. I mean, a sound engineer at a radio station is part of it. The manager for a musician is in this group too, and everything in between. And you're absolutely right. It's not just the creators themselves. It's also, again, journalists, especially journalists who write about music or art or something, are very much parts of the creative class and exposed to the same tensions and you know, sort of threats that the rest of the creative class is exposed to.
There's a lot of despair and hand-wringing over disappearing sectors of the American economy when you look at, you know, sort of rural agrarian economies or, you know, manufacturing plants in middle America. But there's not a lot of love for the unemployed record store clerk, right? Or bookstore clerk.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where you're going with this. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to figure out is how come as Americans we sort of assume that, you know, industry, like, say, you know, I'm from Baltimore, so I remember when steel started to fade out and the sort of sense that something valuable was being lost. And, you know, there are big concerts when farmers suffer. You know, we have a sense that sort of the agrarian economy is the roots of the American character or something. But, you know, the creative output, whether it's, again, novels, movies, music, graphic design, this is sort of what America does best, and it's employed an enormous number of people. But somehow, as you say, we don't see this as a real threat to our identity. We don't see this as a group that we need to save. And there's all kinds of reasons for it. I mean, part of it is that at least since Dan Quayle and Newt Gingrich, there's been a sense that the cultural elite, which is what people who work in the arts or culture have been tarred with, are not, you know, real Americans. You know, not only are they not worthy of sympathy, there's something sort of seditious about them. And it was a great term for the financial class. It meant you could be a billionaire banker in a gated community and you could call a jazz musician or a guy who wrote about art for the newspaper an elitist. You know, the wealthy were no longer the elitist. It was people who liked classical music or people who were into novels or something.
Well, you also point to the internet and smartphones, you know, needing free content as part of the cause for this, but that the devaluing of the arts and humanities has been going on for much longer. What are some of the root causes?
Well, that's a really important part of this. I mean, we had a sense, you know, we in sort of the West, Europe, the States, you know, a sense that the arts were this sort of window into truth or sort of a path into the soul, that whether it was music or poetry or the novel or whatever, that they were essential to our lives. There was wisdom involved. They were transforming. You know, museums were built that looked like temples. You know, there was in the sort of late 19th, early 20th century, there was what you could call sort of culture worship. And there was a sense that there was something very sacred about this stuff. In the mid-century, there was a spreading of high culture to a mass audience, which was extremely important. But then at some point, we started to think about culture in a different way. You had sort of simultaneously Andy Warhol sort of tweaking the seriousness of it and saying that it wasn't really all that important as we thought. You also had what I call market worship startups so in the 70s and 80s, so that if something didn't generate an enormous amount of wealth, there must be something wrong with it. In other words, if your symphony orchestra in your town needs public funding, that clearly it's failed. You know, everything's a business now, and if it can't make it, it's a failure. Mm-hmm. So there were all kinds of shifts in the way we viewed arts and culture. So we used to call it culture, which at least had a sort of resonance to it. Now we call it content, and what happened in between is hard to figure out, but it's crucial to where we are now.
We're speaking with a one-time newspaper arts reporter, Scott Timberg, about his new book called Culture Crash. And this is about how sweeping economic changes are actually endangering the artists and the writers and the musicians and the creative class in America. Well, you also point to self-inflicted wounds, you know, that members of the creative class have had a lot to do with its own destruction. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, there was a sense of purpose, I think, to people who worked in the world of culture, and this includes, say, you know, English professors who pass the torch on to young people. It's true of artists like Warhol. There started to be an idea in the 60s and 70s that arts and culture were not holy, but were rather, you know, something that came out of class relations, or they were sort of an expression of power. And all this stuff came together to kind of dethrone the notion that there was something transcendent about culture. If you look at if you look these days at coverage of, say, visual art in almost every newspaper or mainstream media institution, it's all about the auction prices that the painting got, last night in London or New York or something. This is not the way this stuff was covered in the 50s and 60s, you know, when there was more of a sense that the arts were sort of a window to the soul or a means of transcendence. The creative class spreads the idea to other people about what this stuff means. So if you have, for instance, Warhol telling you that art is just what sells and that mass production is the same as something handmade, after a while, if people start to hear that, they're going to start to wonder, well, why should I consume this stuff, be interested in this stuff, if I could just make more money working on Wall Street?
So that is the loss of culture as sacred cow. But of course, there is also the internet. You know, this rapacious need for new content, I'm going to use that term, has created a competitive freelance economy. What are the drawbacks of that?
Well, as somebody who had a job or various jobs for 15 years and has been a freelancer for six or so, you know, there's this whole sort of gospel that being free and self-branding and going it alone and so on will make everybody, you know, every sort of creative figure healthier, richer, more robust. There are a few people who manage to make it in the new sort of relentless, you know, internet economy. Every person who does make it, by the way, writes a book on it, and you hear about them incessantly about how we live in this sort of great new world where creative people can take the reins themselves. For the vast majority of us, and I'm luckier than most, I wrote for fairly big publications and I'm established in my field. But even somebody at my level and lots of others are struggling to live in American cities as rents and cost of living, even in a recession and a feeble economy, skyrocket. So it's, you know, there's a sort of greater freedom. You can define yourself, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to write 24 hours a day, there's a place to put it. If the issue here, though, is making a living as a musician, a writer, graphic designer, architect, whatever, if the issue is being a full-fledged member of the creative class who can live like a middle-class person, things are not going in the right direction.
Yeah. So you're presenting this idea of an age when only the wealthy can be artists, or the average dancer in America is making $15,000 a year. Do you see a day when culture is a luxury good?
I think that's where we're headed. I mean, you know, people who don't read my books, you know, say things like, oh, you know, there's this guy who thinks that art is going to just suddenly stop, you know, which isn't my argument. You know, my argument is that when artists and craftsmen can't make a living, we all pay the price. And I think that's where we're headed, is to a world in which musicians, artists, writers, et cetera, aren't making money from their work. They're making money because they have an inheritance, or because they have a trust fund, or they're struggling, like most of the people I know, or they decide, you know, I love this stuff and I care about it. I can't do it. I'm dropping out. Those are the things I'm seeing. And again, in being involved in the arts and culture, I don't mean being a full-time classical composer, say, but I mean being involved at some level, whether you're working at a bookstore, whether you're, you know, helping a musician as a publicist. You know, if middle-class people can't get involved in this stuff, we don't really have a real culture anymore. We have kind of a plutocracy.
Well, Scott Tinberg, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for your interest.
Scott Tinberg is a former arts reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's now an L.A.-based culture writer and contributing writer for Salon. You'll find more on his book, Culture Crash, How Sweeping Economic Changes Are Imperiling Artists, Writers, and Musicians in America. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. My So-Called Life, Freaks and Geeks, Arrested Development, all celebrated TV shows that fans and critics argue were canceled too soon. Up next, a TV critic urges us to take pleasure in shows that have been given the axe prematurely. The case for necro-streaming when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When ABC announced this fall that it would cancel Selfie after only six episodes, fans reacted with petitions and harsh words for the network on Twitter. Critics posted their regrets on Salon and The New Republic. Television critic and film studies professor Philip Masiak found himself much more interested in watching the remaining episodes of a show that did not yet know that it was dead. What, he asked on the Dear Television blog on the Los Angeles Review of Books, can we understand about our own viewing practices by reveling in the God's eye view of a crashing train. Television fans, welcome to the revelatory pastime of necro-streaming. Philip Masiak is going to guide us through. Hello, Philip.
Hi, Virginia.
Let's hear just a little clip from Selfie, which had achieved a kind of cult status and a will-they-or-won't-they romantic tension between leads Karen Gillan and John Cho.
I don't want you to think that I value my job more than I value a friendship. Because I swear, it's a tie.
A tie?
Yes, a tie.
There is no way that you came galloping out here on that majestic horse bathed in moonlight to tell me it's a tie.
I took the least majestic horse, I swear. In the stable, this thing looked like a donkey.
John Cho there with Karen Gillan. It didn't get a lot of viewers, the show, but it wasn't a mercy killing by ABC. A lot of people really liked it. What did you think?
I liked it a lot. The reason I was paying attention to it at all is that Dear Television did a kind of recap of the new sitcoms at the beginning of the season. And I did this with my friend Jane Hu. And Selfie was really the one that stood out of all of the new crop of sitcoms as being a little bit smarter than the rest of them, having performances that were a little bit more compelling, a little bit more fully realized. And it was by no means a perfect show, but it was certainly one that looked like it had a little bit of promise. And I think the cult following that you mentioned is kind of a testament to that, or testimony to that.
But does knowing it's canceled make it better to you somehow?
I don't know if it makes it better, but it certainly makes it a more interesting viewing experience. I think the reason why I zeroed in on Selfie especially is because outside of its kind of, you know, socially progressive casting and its kind of, you know, sharp sense of humor, it wasn't a show that, you know, somebody like me would spend that much time writing about, or that my readers would spend that much time reading about, except for the fact that it got canceled. I think having it be canceled, and more importantly, having there be still episodes left after the cancellation, made it a slightly more interesting thing to behold. You could watch it try to find its feet with full knowledge that it wasn't ever going to find its feet. Or you could hope for a resolution to a plot line, or hope for, you know, one or two little glitches in the way that the show was written to get sorted out, knowing that you might well never see those things happen.
You did compare it to a similarly risky show with a similarly explosive female lead, is I think how you put it. Jane the Virgin, mm-hmm. This was on the CW right. Network. A Golden Globe for acting, yeah, for Gina Rodriguez last week. Now here she is in a scene with Andrea Nevedo, who plays her mother.
How was your meeting with your father?
How do you think it was? We're strangers. I don't know anything about him, and he doesn't know anything about me.
I'm sorry, Jane.
Yeah. You know, you keep saying that. But it's hard to get to the it's okay part, because it's not okay. What you did to me, what you took away from me, it's not okay. And I just don't understand how you could have done it.
Because you're not a mother yet.
Okay, that's a show that made it, a scene from Jane the Virgin. Back to that comparison with Selfie then. Why does this work and Selfie doesn't? Or I guess to go with what you were talking about, what would it look like if it were on the chopping block?
Right. I think that was the main comparison. I mean, I think, to be clear, I think Jane the Virgin is a pretty solidly better show than Selfie really ever was. It's the leads are fantastic, especially Gina Rodriguez, who just won the Golden Globe. And the show itself is a much more complicated and sort of interestingly constructed piece of television, the way that it mashes together a telenovela and sitcom and romantic comedy and drama all together is really, it's a fantastic piece of work. But I think at the time that I wrote the piece, Jane the Virgin and Selfie were, you know, similarly shows that were just starting to gain an audience, just starting to sort of show their full potential. And I think it's an interesting kind of thought experiment to imagine how we would have seen, say, the rest of the first season of Jane the Virgin if it had been canceled after four or five episodes, mm-hmm. just in the same way that we saw Selfie. So some of the kind of more outlandish jokes, some of the kind of riskier moves that Gina Rodriguez made as an actress, you know, instead of being praised by us as things that kept the show afloat, could very easily have been read by viewers as signs that ship was sinking. Very much,
yeah,
like a lot of the things that we see on Selfie.
Yeah, I can imagine that sort of, you know, sinking, the cringy feeling that, oh, no wonder it was canceled kind of thing.
Exactly.
I'm speaking with the TV critic and film studies professor, Philip Masiak, about necro-streaming. That is the practice of watching or binging on television shows that have already been canceled, and how that really changes the viewing experience. Well, Philip, see, we talk about necro-streaming shows that don't know yet that they are dead, but are shows that know they're getting the axe and how they play with that notion can be interesting. Here's a clip. This is from the second to the last episode of Arrested Development. It was called Exit Strategy. Now, they knew they were getting the axe. In this scene, Michael Bluth has discovered a model home in Iraq inhabited entirely by Saddam Hussein impersonators. How Arrested Development of a construction is that? Let's hear.
Scar on that one dude's forehead's got to be a problem.
That's Ahmed. Never stop watching the trial. We are all following it pretty closely.
I understand. They put this guy away. You guys are out of a job, huh?
Yes, and we wanted to keep the house for just one more season.
That show was revived by Netflix, and we also think of Freaks and Geeks, a show that knew it was being canceled. Now, how did they tie it up?
Well, Freaks and Geeks, I think, attempted to give a kind of sense of closure. I don't think it was as sort of meta and self-conscious as Arrested Development's. But I do think that, you know, this is a spoiler, although it's years past, so I'm not really afraid about spoiling it for people. But having Lindsay Weir, the protagonist of the show, run off with a bunch of hippies following the Grateful Dead was both a kind of romantic way to end the show and also a kind of silly way to end the show, to sort of imagine that, you know, there's freaks and there's geeks, and then there's, you know, hippies. There's a third category. But I think that that phenomenon is a kind of allied phenomenon that happens on the part of writers and producers, right? So if necro-streaming is something that we do as viewers when we know a show has been canceled, there's a different type of thing that that producers and writers will do when they know a show is getting canceled. So Freaks and Geeks and Arrested Development are big examples of this. But I even think about a show like Parks and Recreation. Mike Schur, who's the showrunner for that show, has said on a number of occasions that most of the seasons that they've shot, they've finished and wrapped without knowing if they were going to be renewed for another season. And so if you go back and watch all of the seasons of Parks and Recreation, they end generally on a note where the showrunner would feel okay ending the series on that note. Well, and I think a lot of shows that are on the edge like that tend to do similar things.
So let's talk about the difference between a show that knows it has come to its end. I mean, I'm thinking of The Sopranos, for example, or Seinfeld, or Lost. The last episodes of those shows became significant in and of themselves and are still even talked about compared to a series like HBO's Deadwood. Did Deadwood know it was getting canceled?
You know, I'm not 100% sure that it did. I believe that David Milch wrote the last, you know, few episodes with the idea that there would be closure there in case it didn't go on. Although you shouldn't quote me on that. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a difference. You know, it doesn't always favor the thing you'd think it would favor between a show that is able to fully craft its perfect ending and a show that has the rug pulled out from under it. I think something like, you know, a show like Selfie or any number of other shows, you know, can very often have this kind of pleasant sense of possibility at the end of the run. So you can think about where it would have gone or what might have happened. We don't know what season 2, 3, or 4 of Freaks and Geeks would have been like. Whereas something like Lost, which had a highly anticipated ending and showrunners who were really concerned about crafting a perfect ending, that ending really fell flat for a lot of people. And I think, you know, you ask a lot of fans, and I won't say if I'm one of them, although I totally am, who would say that I would have been happy if they would have just been canceled at the end of the second to last season. And that ending, even though it lacks the kind of closure that the ultimate ending did, would have been a little bit more satisfying to me because I felt that it was really a part of the way that the show operated and part and parcel of what I liked about it.
Is there a right way then, Philip, to tie up a show? I mean, ending on a good note can, you know, help sort of hide a multitude of sins, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's really true, and we have a great, you know, deal of examples of both good and bad endings. So, you know, Cheers is always an ending that gets trotted out as a kind of perfect ending, or MASH. Whereas we have Lost and Seinfeld as endings that of beloved shows that kind of fell flat with audiences. It's hard to say, and I think a lot of times a showrunner or a writer's room feels that they need to sort of move outside of what the show normally does in order to end it. So Seinfeld, for instance, had this big kind of field trip, and they go to jail, and all of this crazy stuff happens, which is very out of keeping with the ordinary way that Seinfeld was shot. I think it'll be really interesting to see, for instance, how Mad Men ends in just a couple of months. Another ending that's been really, really hotly anticipated, and could either, you know, go the way of MASH and be counted as one of its best episodes, or be really divisive, like Lost or even The Sopranos.
Mad Men, my prediction, they all run off and join the Grateful Dead.
If only.
Philip Maciak teaches English and film at LSU and writes the Dear Television blog for the LA Review of Books. Thanks so much, Philip.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
You can read his article about the instructive nature of necro-streaming. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for listening today. There is so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We urge you to take a peek. Earlier in the show, we heard a defense of office life and culture, and we're compiling a list of movies where the office plays a key role. Think 9 to 5 or Office Space. You can send us your suggestions on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or send an email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.